The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This episode is brought to you by my friend Rebecca Walzer. Rebecca is a financial expert who can help you protect your wealth during this volatile market. Book your complimentary call with her team by going to friendofdinesh.com. Today, I want to talk about the deep divisions rending, dividing the country, and ask whether we can ever be one nation again. Danielle D'Souza Gill is going to join me. We're going to talk about the landmark Dobbs decision overturning Roe versus Wade. I'm going to explore a strange new report in Georgia that might help explain why the Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, is moving so slowly with his investigation into ballot trafficking. And I'm going to do my introduction to the Iliad as part of a study of Homer's two great epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Show.
Needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
I talk frequently, and Debbie and I do also, on the podcast about the divide between red America, blue America. But is this divide getting worse? Are we, in fact, approaching what could be called a great divergence in which two parts of the country really pull almost irreconcilably apart? I say irreconcilably because you can only have a common ground when you agree about your goals, but you disagree about means. If you agree that America should be prosperous, you can argue about how to get there. If you agree on protecting life, you can argue about what's the best way to do that. Problem is when the two sides want to go in different directions. They disagree about ends. Now, this certainly occurred in the time leading up to the Civil War, in which the essentially Whig and then Republican North began to diverge from the pro-slavery Democratic South and disagree fundamentally. It wasn't just at the time of the founding, there was a kind of virtually universal agreement that slavery was a bad thing, even if it should be temporarily tolerated, it should not be allowed to grow or to expand, and the slave trade should not be allowed to proliferate. But what happened in the early 19th century was you got two sides, one of which basically said slavery is bad and should be restricted, the other which said slavery is good and should be expanded. And that was the cleavage that produced ultimately the horrific Civil War. Now, interestingly, today you may say our situation isn't that. We don't have a single issue like slavery, but in some ways it's even worse because we disagree on so many things. The Americans of the 19th century agreed on most things. They agreed about hard work and industry and free markets. Even the South, with this big feudal or semi-feudal institution of slavery, was part of a global free market. They were selling cotton on the open market, selling it to England. They were part of global, you may say, free trade. And so here's an interesting article written from the left by Michael Podhoretzer, or at least they're referring to an analysis by Michael Podhoretzer. And what he says is that America has had these divisions that are sort of deeply embedded in the country for a long time. But he argues that there was a temporary truce, a kind of American coming together from the 1930s to the 1980s, a kind of half century in which these differences became moderated. He doesn't really explain why he thinks that that was the case. He seems to suggest maybe it's because of the welfare state. I actually don't think that's the main cause. In my view, if this is right, if there was a temporary moderation, it was really due to the sort of two massive events of the Depression and World War II. There's nothing like hardship and scarcity, perhaps even the Cold War, the existential threat from abroad, tends to bring a country together and blur differences. But, says Podhorza, with all that now having receded, the differences have become really stark. And blue people, he argues, and I find this a little hard to believe, but this in a way ratifies his point. He says blue people like to live in blue America. They think it's more modern, it's more technological, it's more high tech, it includes Silicon Valley. And they don't care that much about the things that red people care about. They know that red America is safer. They know that red America has better housing prices. They know that red America has more economic opportunity. In fact, why do you think people are moving from the blue states to the red states? It's because jobs are more plentiful. The weather is generally better, with, of course, the signal, with the notable exception of California. And the red states are actually in many ways booming. They're safer. They support family values. But Horace's point is maybe the blue people don't care about those things. They don't care about family values. They would rather live in a kind of college town environment where you have weirdness all around, you know, keep Austin weird. And they prefer that lifestyle. They don't mind if their car gets occasionally burgled, I suppose. Now, he's not saying that this is going to lead to civil war. It could, but it might not. It could be that you just have these two. It's kind of like two neighbors. They're going to live side by side, and they really don't like each other, and they don't speak a lot, and they clash a lot over, you know, your tree fell over my lawn, and so on. And they obviously, in this case, the clash is also because we have a shared federal government that appropriates resources from both blue and red America and then disperses them according to an ideology that at least now seems clearly aligned with blue America. There's some nonsense in this article that I will ignore completely about how red America is more authoritarian. This is all complete nonsense. Red America is no more authoritarian. In fact, blue America is authoritarian. Maybe even this perspective reflects the divide again, that those of us who sympathize with red America see blue America as trying to impose its will on us. And then from the left, they think that red America, which they consider to be a minority. Now, it's not a minority in terms of physical size or even in terms of counties or even in terms of people. Red America as a group is about the same size as blue America. But they think that blue America has a certain kind of democratic priority. And red Americans, using such tools as the Supreme Court and the Senate, are trying to somehow suppress blue America from exercising its natural majority over the entire country. Recently, I told you Walmart has canceled MyPillow. Walmart, they will no longer be selling Mike's products at their stores. When are these retailers going to stop letting the left bully them into submission? Enough is enough. Well, Mike always fires back, and he comes out with new products and new deals, and I'm excited to announce the MyPillow sandals. Hey, summer is here. You're going to need some waterproof sandals to go to the beach, the pool, anywhere. These sandals aren't just practical. They're super comfortable. We just got some. Can't believe how cushiony they are. Regular price of these MyPillow sandals, $79.98, but now on sale, $49.98 with promo code Dinesh. So call 800-876-0227, that number 800-876-0227, or go to mypillow.com. Don't forget to use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. There's a startling article in Gateway Pundit that is talking about Georgia and talking about the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger. And they quote a guy from a group, a conservative group in Georgia that is called Voter Georgia, Voter GA. This is Garland Favorito. And he says, with regard to Brad, meaning Raffensperger, I don't think anyone believes down here that he actually won. When I saw this, I was like, what does that mean? Well, Raffensperger won his primary for Secretary of State, but surveys had shown that he was deeply unpopular in the state. So a lot of people in Georgia were like, wow, how is it that he won and won rather decisively and won even more than he was predicted to win before the primary itself? He was leading right before, but his margin was substantially even bigger. Well, this group called Voter Georgia, Voter GA, has put out a report basically alleging, and I want to emphasize alleging, that the Georgia voting system seems to have added 15% of votes to Raffensperger's total. And so their Voter Georgia is now filing, has filed a challenge in all 159 counties. And they are saying that these, that the vote count, which is, by the way, Dominion vote count for the Secretary of State, is not accurate, and that he certified these unlawful results. So basically what Voter Georgia wants to do is unseal the ballots so that you can count the ballots and match them up against the results that were given by the machines. I mean, this would seem to be something rather obvious and easy to do, and I don't see why they haven't done it already, if anything, to build confidence in the results. But this is what the article alleges, and it's coming from Voter Georgia, that Raffensperger received about 53% of the Republican Day votes, while the Dominion voting system awarded him 68.4% of those votes for Secretary of State. So they're basically saying that 15% of the votes. Now, ordinarily, I'd be very skeptical, and of course, I'm just relaying this information as something that is being challenged. But let's remember that just a few days ago, I talked about a CISA report. CISA here standing for the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Agency of the federal government that monitors election practices. And CISA said that these machines, and they specifically noted Dominion, can be manipulated. Now, of course, the CISA didn't say that they were, in fact, manipulated. And that's what Voter Georgia seems to be saying. Not only did they, was it possible to do it, but that it seems to have been done in this case. And Voter Georgia goes on to point out that there were some other races where you seem to have had problematic results. I'm just going to read a line here. In DeKalb County, District 2 Commission, Democrat Party candidate Michelle Long Spears received zero votes in a precinct where she and her husband live. In other words, she and her husband obviously voted for her, and yet somehow she got zero votes in her own district. And so the issue here isn't entirely partisan, because obviously here we're talking about a Democrat. We're just talking about creating in the voters' minds the confidence that these elections are being properly tabulated. I mean, this is a confidence that I had, you know, for 40 years, having come to America in the 70s. I'd never dreamed as I go in to cast my ballot that there'd be some shenanigans in the counting or somebody is somehow rigging the process. But now, as you know, there is a deep lack of faith in our institutions. And although we don't cover the issue of the machines at all in 2000 Mules, it does seem like there are some problems that need to be attended to. I mean, for me, the real issue is this. Raffensperger announced that he was doing an investigation in Georgia into ballot trafficking following a report filed with him by True the Vote. Now, that investigation appears to be moving, let's just say, at a Durham-like tortoise pace. And my question is why? They actively seem to be like beating down the wrong door. Why aren't they actually just interviewing the mules? If you don't want to arrest the mules, nevertheless, unmask them, just talk to them. Take that as a first step. Ask them, because if you talk to enough mules, 250 mules roughly in the Atlanta area, some of them are going to fess up and tell you what's going on. But interestingly, they don't seem to want to do that. And they're resisting that. And what they want True the Vote to do is turn over the name of the whistleblower who doesn't want his name to be found. So until you can find the whistleblower, he goes into hiding, the whole thing. So the point being, I'm not really sure if they are moving the investigation forward or if Raffensperger himself is stalling it and even pulling it back. And look, if you've got a system that is rigged and some of the elected people are sort of benefiting from it or in on it, or they've got some stake in the process as it is, this would help to explain why they're not jumping to fix the system. Why? Because this is the very system that put them in office, keeps them in office, and maybe makes sure that they will never be displaced from office. This next message, guys, is from First Liberty, and I'm going to have Kelly Shackelford, the head, the president of First Liberty, on the podcast tomorrow. One of the big issues they care about is court packing, and this is a real danger to our democracy. I mean, make no mistake, court packing is a kind of coup, and the usual suspects, Biden, Pelosi, Schumer, are working overtime on new radical plans to pack the Supreme Court. Kelly Shackelford knows if we don't stop them from installing four more justices so they can rig the system in their favor, it's going to be catastrophic for the country, for the court, hey, for our way of life. So we can't let that happen, not on our watch. That's why First Liberty needs you to join them. They're gathering a coalition of a million patriots to say no to court backing, no to the liberal agenda, no to the Supreme Court coup. Franklin Graham, former U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese, Dr. James Dobson, the Family Policy Alliance, the Heritage Foundation, and over 400,000 people like you are on board. So please sign your name now. Go to Supreme Coup, that's C-O-U-P. Go to supremecoup.com to sign First Liberty's letter. That's supremecoup.com. God bless America. Guys, my daughter Danielle D'Souza Gill is the author of far and away the best book on abortion in recent years. It's called The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America. If you are interested in this issue, this is the book for you. It's in no way obsolete because of the court's decision. In fact, if anything, it lays out the world after Roe, and it's something that you should really check out. Danielle, welcome to the podcast. I see you're wearing a message-containing cap. What does your cap say?
Well, my hat says my pronouns are anti-abortion because the left has asked us to choose our pronouns. And so if I don't have my usual pronoun, she, her, then it's anti-abortion.
Good stuff. And by the way, you now have a merchandise store where you have all kinds of stuff, not just on the pro-life issue, but on a whole bunch of issues. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's called Americana by Danielle. You can get my book, which is signed on there. You can also get this hat. You can get tumblers. You can get other products, too, that are just American in general beyond the pro-life stuff. But right now, I feel like the pro-life issue is really out there in the forefront. So that is something I'm focusing on the most.
And what is that website?
It's called AmericanaByDanielle.com.
AmericanaByDanielle.com. Okay, let's talk about this incredible shift that has now occurred, a legal shift. But we all know that legal shifts produce moral shifts and cultural shifts. We saw that with the civil rights movement, for example. Just talk about, I mean, this is an issue that has passionately concerned you really since you were much younger. You wrote a book. You devoted a year of your life to focusing on this issue. You have spoken at pro-life groups and you have a good feeling for the pro-life community. What was your reaction? And where do you think this is going to go from here?
Well, I think it was mostly just really exciting. I think the news was just so amazing and people were overjoyed by it. But I think, unfortunately, because we always focus on the left's evil tactics and their vitriol and hatred, it kind of overshadows things. And sometimes because, you know, they are deciding to, you know, heckle the Supreme Court justices or go protest and act like there's a federal ban on abortion when really it's gone back to the states and people in New York and California have basically the same lives they always did. Nothing's really changed for them. They that sometimes distracts us from all of the good news with what's been happening. So I think we have to celebrate it because sometimes we only focus on the doom and gloom side of things. And we've actually had a lot of big wins with this and religious freedom and the Second Amendment. So a lot of good things are happening.
I mean, this court has really come through, I think, in a way that maybe we didn't fully expect. It seemed like it was a lot more precarious. And it's not that our instincts were wrong. I mean, we knew that John Roberts would try to straddle the middle. Sure enough, even in this case, Roberts came along and said, you know, I would have essentially a protected role, but nevertheless, I would have allowed the Mississippi law, which I guess would mean that there would be regulation post 15 weeks. What I think is interesting is that Roberts was not able to persuade a single justice to adopt that middle ground. Why do you think that the court decided, let's just go the whole hog, and Roberts was so unsuccessful?
Well, I think Roberts is basically the same as this very small group of Americans, too, who are like him. Unfortunately, Roberts is kind of moved to the center, so to speak. He's not really conservative. But I think that most conservative people would actually say this is moderate. Overturning Roe v. Wade is moderate because it just sends it back to the states. It's a huge victory. But, again, it means that people can get these 9-month abortions in places like New York and California. So it's not like we're having some kind of radical law here. And I think when the left acts like that, it's clearly just not in tune with what states are actually voting on and what's happening around the country. So I think the fact that Roberts kind of wanted to protect Roe and wanted this maybe middle situation to act as though maybe it's not viability, but let's move it to 15 weeks or something, is something that really nobody agrees with, because the radical left wants no restrictions at all. And the pro-life side, we do want restrictions. And we see that sending it back to the states is really just the first step.
I mean, even if you are in a red state that is either regulating abortion or outlawing it, I mean, all you have to do, in a sense, is travel to a blue state where abortion is permitted and you can get your abortion. In that sense, if you look at it that way, the ability to get an abortion as a practical matter remains relatively easy. So I see what you're saying when you're saying that Roe is a huge victory. You can't call it anything but a victory. But at the same time, it is scarcely a ban on abortion, even in the red states, because you can simply hop over and get an abortion and come back home.
Yeah. And unfortunately, these leftist companies, they're starting to now say they're paying for people. They're going to have them travel, they're going to put out memos saying you feel free to relocate and all of this stuff because you may want an abortion in the future. In other words, you're not in that predicament right now. You're not pregnant right now, but hey, move there so you can kind of sleep with anyone in case you may want to plan for a future abortion, even though nobody ever plans for an abortion. So it's a very strange situation there. Of course, I think people would say they'd rather not be in that situation. So it really is just strange how they want people to get abortions. And I think it's because these companies know that it's cheaper for them to basically pay to abort rather than pay for maternity leave or, deal with another human being long term. They don't want people to actually be mothers. They basically just want them to be in cubicles all of the time, turned into these community workers.
Let's take a pause and come back and talk some more about all this. We'll be right back. Are you watching your retirement slip through your hands every day? Are you worried about a black swan market event that could be inevitably coming? This is an event that comes out of nowhere and basically decimates your accumulated savings. And that's not all. Look at interest rates going up, inflation skyrocketing. How can we protect our money? How can you get ahead of what's happening with the economy? This is not a time to wing it or go with a hunch. You need a qualified expert on your side. Well, I'm not an expert, but my friend Rebecca Walzer is. She's a tax attorney and wealth strategist with her MBA from the London School of Economics. Rebecca and her team will help to prepare you and your money for the turbulent times ahead. We all work hard for our money. We can use some really good guidance to help us build on what we have. Go to friendofdinesh.com and book your complimentary introductory call today to see if you qualify. That's friendofdinesh.com. Let Rebecca Walzer's team of experts protect your wealth during these unprecedented times. I'm back with Danielle D'Souza Gill. We're talking about life after Roe. She's the author of The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America. So Danielle, when this decision came out, I was really struck by something that Trump said. He said, God did this, right? And for a while, I thought to myself, what an interesting thing to say. And I interpreted this way, that you got two camps on this issue. And one camp is made up of, in some ways, the most evil and selfish people in America. And the other camp is made up of the sweetest and simplest and most unselfish people in America, because even if they win, they don't get anything out of it. They're fighting for the lives of other people. And so it's rare in a society where normally the wolves get the better of the sheep. This was sort of a win for the sheep. And in that sense, I think that's the true meaning of Trump's God did this, because it's almost like you need a shepherd to intervene on behalf of the sheep for the sheep to win a big one against the wolves. I'd just like you to comment about the pro-life community, and because they're also now getting ready for a big struggle in the States. Are they up to that task?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, it's very much reminds me of kind of the parable of the lost sheep, of the lost coin, where the shepherd says, you know, have my 99 sheep, but I'm still going to go out there looking for the last one. And I think that's what the pro-life movement is going to do. We're going to say, you know what, we've saved so many babies now. This is such a huge victory. Only God could have done this. But we're not going to give up, because there are still babies in these other states who are going to be at huge risk of being killed in the womb. And so we're not going to give up until every single last sheep we have, you know, found again. And so I think that pro-lifers are probably just invigorated from this, and probably are going to see this as something they've prayed for a long time. But we're definitely going to keep working on this. It's really just gone back to the States, and that doesn't mean that this is over.
Yeah. How do you explain the extreme reaction of the left on this? I mean, is it just that, I mean, I've seen these videos of these women and they're like breathing heavily, and then they start sputtering, and then they start shrieking, and it's almost like they are having a traumatic reaction. And then I say to myself, well, this woman appears to be in Portland or appears to be in California. In some ways, their life is unaffected by this, but it appears that nevertheless, their psyche is disturbed by it. So how do you interpret the behavior of someone like that? Because they're clearly not faking it. They're genuinely freaked out. What are they freaked out about?
Yeah, I think it reminds me of when I was in college. I was in a sorority that I ended up leaving and depledging from because it was a horrible place. But the charity that they always did was for St. Jude's Hospital, and it was for cancer. And then they said, let's not do that anymore. Let's actually change the charity so that we raise money for women to have abortions in Texas, where they might not have as much access to abortion. Now, these women were not from Texas, did not live in Texas. Most of them have never been to Texas. This college was on the East Coast. So I think to them, they love abortion, and they see it as abortion is something that's a great good, and they want as many people as possible to have abortions and have this access to abortion, just like we might speak about the gospel. So I think that to say that, oh, well, just because they live in a liberal state doesn't affect them, well, to them, it's not personal. To them, it's, you know, we want to make sure these other women are doing it, even women that they've never met before. So I think their love for abortion is much deeper than really we can even understand, because it just seems so sickening to us. And when we see these images of these women, you know, with these huge pregnant stomachs saying like not a human inside with arrows, we're like, oh my gosh, this must be just some random deranged individual. But actually, there are many people like that on the radical left who are these big protesters. And that's the message they're spreading in colleges. Those are the people that they recruit to become activists. And so it's actually much more widespread and not just focused on self-interest or themselves. They want to spread this message.
I mean, I saw something yesterday, an image that really disturbed me. I mentioned on the podcast, you have a woman, she has two kids. They're something like 7 and 5, really cute. And she's at obviously a pro-choice rally. And she has a sign that says, no one should have to go through this. That's her sign, right? And I was thinking to myself, now it could be that she just made the sign and then just grabbed her kids and told them to come. But when you look at the picture, she appears to be saying, no one should have to go through the agony of what I've had to put through with these two on my hands. It's almost like, I mean, it seems just such a violation. Forget about the scripture or the sacraments. It's a violation of that basic bond between mother and child. And for me, it was dramatized in that photo. So what you're saying really is, for these people, abortion has become a positive good in the same way that slavery became a positive good for an element of the South, the Democratic South, in the 19th century.
Yeah, I mean, this woman on The View named Sarah Haynes, who's supposedly the moderate Democrat, she's from Iowa or something. And, you know, compared to Whoopi Goldberg and Joy Behar, I guess she's supposedly the moderate one. But she basically has said in the past, you know, the older my kids get, and I think she has a couple kids, you know, the more kids I have, the more I realize why people don't want them. And the more I realize why people would never want to have kids, basically. And I mean, I think that would just be so sad to be her kids watching her say this on television, because she's basically saying, the more I get to know you, the more I hate you or find you to be a great burden on me. So I think it's really the opposite of the pro-life message, which is, oh, actually, we're saying this might seem like a very crazy and surprising thing, but once you get to know this child and they're older, you will be so glad that you have them. But she's basically saying the opposite. And again, I'm not saying, you know, that it's like that for everybody, but I'm saying that I do think that's becoming a more popular feeling on the left, to basically say, if you hate your kids and things like that, that's an okay feeling. Because on the left, they don't ever want to say anything's not an okay thing. They want everything to be celebrated, everything to be accepted. And the only things that are not okay to them are right-wing things. But if it's things like, I dislike my children, even though they're eight-year-olds or whatever, they haven't done anything to you, that's okay to view them as just a complete nuisance.
Let's take a pause. When we come back, we'll talk more with Danielle D'Souza Gill, author of The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America. You've noticed it's pretty colorful at the grocery store in the produce section, all those vibrant colors of fruits and veggies. Our friend Dr. Howard at Balance of Nature explains that all those colors you see represent nutritional variety. Different colors signify different key nutrients. So if you eat only your favorite one or two veggies, well, you're missing a whole world of vital nutrients. That's why Debbie and I take those six little fruits and veggie capsules every day. Each daily dose is made up of a blend of 31 different fruits and veggies. 31. So variety equals vitality. Give your body everything it needs with Balance of Nature. Invest in your health. Join me and experience the Balance of Nature difference for years to come. For a limited time, all new preferred customers get an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. Use discount code BALANCE. Call 800-246-8751. That's 800-246-8751, or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code BALANCE. I'm back with Danielle D'Souza Gill, author of The Choice. And Danielle, I noticed that you're actually becoming much more active on social media. You're posting a lot on Instagram. You're all over Truth Social. Tell people where they can follow you on social media.
I'm at Danielle D'Souza Gill on all the platforms. And you can find me on, yeah, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, even though they're crazy platforms. But I like to be everywhere just in case you don't have Truth Social, Rumble, Getter, Parler, all the other ones. So I'm on all the platforms.
Okay. Let's talk about Biden. He has been criticized for not doing enough to respond to the Supreme Court decision. So finally, he's come out and said he would support a carve out of the filibuster for a narrow Democratic majority, basically 50 plus Kamala Harris, to pass a federal law enabling abortion, essentially codifying, as they say, Roe. In fact, their law would go beyond Roe. But nevertheless, this is Biden's strategy. Doesn't seem to me it's going to go anywhere. But nevertheless, this is at least Biden's way of saying, I tried to do something. And knowing the Democrats, they're going to try to push it.
Right. I mean, I think at this point, it's just so clear that Biden acted like he would be a moderate. He acted like he was the most moderate of all the other Democrats who ran for the primary for president. But he clearly is so radical, and he clearly is pro-abortion at this point. I don't even think people can take seriously a lot of his words, because we know that they're coming from his administration, maybe Kamala Harris, Obama, people around him. But I think that it's clear that the left has really become obsessed with abortion to a point where even someone who is, you know, out of their mind, someone who clearly wasn't from a generation that was pro-abortion, is saying this just because this is the one issue they're willing to carve out with the filibuster. This is their one big issue. That's their message. And basically what they want to run on in the midterms is, hey, you know, abortion, abortion, abortion. Do you love abortion? If so, make sure to vote for us. And I think that that's just a huge mess.
Did you see AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? She was implying that, in effect, you're not really pro-life. You're not consistently pro-life, or you're a little bit of a hypocrite if you support the court's decision, and at the same time don't support, let's call it, assuming responsibility for everybody else's kids. So if you don't support universal health care, if you don't support paid maternity leave and this and that and this and that, and I'm thinking to myself, there's a logical fallacy here. I mean, if I don't want my neighbor to kill his kids or molest them, it doesn't follow that I'm willing to take lifelong responsibility for them. I just want this evil to be stopped. And what my position is on all the other issues is a separate matter. But there's nothing inconsistent in saying, stop killing your kids, stop molesting your kids. And he can't turn around and say, well, I'll only do that if you agree to take them over and give them, pay for their education and pay for their health care and so on. I don't have to do that. I can merely take the position that what you're doing is wrong and immoral and should be illegal.
Yeah, I mean, also, I think that she's conflating the word pro-life with basically anything she wants. In her mind, socialism is pro-life. So I would have to just directly respond and say it's not pro-life because, as we know, socialism leads to starvation, it leads to death, it leads to the destruction of an entire society. So I would say that is not pro-life. But also, I think I could say, well, the Second Amendment is, quote, pro-life because I'm using it to defend my life. I'm using it to protect myself. That saves lives. So we can take the word life out of context in any way to make it mean whatever we want. And I think that that makes no sense. But when it comes to her social programs and healthcare and all of this stuff, I think I would just say that, you know, Elizabeth Warren has talked about this, kind of having these government daycare centers. She's obsessed with talking about, you know, mamas and so on, even though this actually would be horrible. If we actually put our children in government facilities, I think they would be, you know, disgusting, not even cleaned and horribly run. As you see photos of children, school food, they get like a tiny piece of a sandwich and that's supposed to be lunch. So first of all, the idea that that's even helping people is completely wrong. I think that through private institutions, through no longer, you know, strangling these crisis pregnancy centers, churches, places that actually want to help women and raise money for them, the left basically tries to stop them. They try to shut them down. They try to put them out of business. And I think that we could find a home for every single child who is not wanted by these women, because there are, you know, vastly more people, families waiting to adopt than there are even children available. So I think putting them with parents, grandparents, homes of people who actually want to care for them and love them, as opposed to sending them to be burdens on the state, would be much better for them and their actual lives.
Absolutely. Great stuff, Danielle. Thank you so much for coming on. And folks, check out The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America, and also Danielle's merchandise store. Talk to you later.
Thanks.
Some of us wish we could rewind the clock when it comes to our health. You know, exercising, climbing stairs, all the stuff young people take for granted, these aren't things that have to stop just because you age. Neither do you have to just endure and suffer the normal aging aches and pains. Now, there's a solution. It's 100% drug-free. It's called Relief Factor. Relief Factor supports your body's fight against inflammation. That's the source of aches and pains. The vast majority of people who try Relief Factor order more because it works for them. Debbie's excited. She finally gets to do her bar exercise class now that she's alleviated her frozen shoulder thanks to Relief Factor. She also knows if she stops taking it, well, the pain could come right back. So she's like, I don't want to be without this again. You too can benefit. Try it for yourself. Order the 3-week quick start for the discounted price of just $19.95. Go to relieffactor.com or call 833-690-7246 to find out more about this offer. That's 833-690-7246. So go to relieffactor.com. Feel the difference. Donald Trump has a new statement out. It came out actually a couple of days ago. I think he's responding to all these never-Trumpers cheering on Liz Cheney and cheering on the January 6th committee. And it's a very Trumpian statement. I like to comment on it because I listen to all these foolish, parentheses, stupid people, often living in a bygone era. Very interesting here. Trump is saying that these never-Trumpers don't understand America as it is now. I think that's right, by the way. Like the weak and frail rhino Peggy Noonan, who did much less for Reagan than she claims, who actually said bad things about him and his ability to speak. Interesting here on Peggy. I've always liked Peggy Noonan. And yet Peggy, I think, is living in that kind of Reagan fog. In other words, I think she doesn't see that the Democratic Party has become gangsterized. very different than, let's say, the old days of Mondale and Carter and certainly Michael Dukakis. And then Trump goes on, Rich Lowry has destroyed the once wonderful and influential National Review, the pride and joy of the legendary William F. Buckley. Well, I mean, you have to admit that National Review is not what it was. And the successors of Buckley, the whole team, is just markedly inferior intellectually, culturally, educationally, to the very sophisticated crowd that I'm used to, that I kind of came of age under. People like Jeffrey Hart, Professor Dartmouth, and Joe Sobran, kind of, which is legendary wit. And then, of course, earlier figures like Whitaker Chambers and Frank Meyer. And you look at the sort of sorry crowd now, and it's just downright, it's an embarrassment. It's sort of like the degenerate children of, you know, a once important dynasty. Or George Will, whose mind is decayed with hatred and envy before our eyes. George Will is a very strange character. I mean, he was genuinely urbane and witty and on point in the Reagan years and even afterward, a very pungent, acerbic critic of the Clintons. And then I think somehow he got the sort of Trump derangement syndrome and began to lose his grip on things. Well, I mean, he's also lost a lot of his eloquence, and he was always something of an opportunist. I always noticed that with George Will, he was sort of, he'd find out the issue that was most important to the left and surrender on that issue. And then he'd be reliably conservative on everything else. This was almost a formula, a career formula that he used. It made him a darling of the Washington Post, of Meg Greenfield, who was the editorial page editor of the Washington Post. It also kept him on ABC News because it was like Will knew when to sell out. And he always sold out when there was money to be made. And then Trump goes on to attack a couple of other people who are really not worth attacking, Jonah Goldberg, Stephen Hayes. He says that they are finally out of the conversation. When were they in it? And of no relevance whatsoever. Well, yes. And then he goes on to say something very interesting. People like these are nasty, jealous, not smart, and of no use to the potential greatness of our country. They talk, they criticize, they complain, but they don't have the ability or talent to get anything done. They are short-sighted losers, and losers is in quote marks. Trump here is, I mean, Trump has, in some ways, I think that Trump can be irresponsible in that he strafes his own side. But in this case, these people are not on his side. In fact, they are willing to sell out conservatism and the Republican Party because of their animus toward Trump. So he's completely justified in striking back against them. They don't hesitate to strike out against him. And the point he's making here is that what have these guys ever done? What have they ever gotten done? Well, you can say they got done the Weekly Standard, a small magazine. I wrote for it at one time, but the Weekly Standard is no more. It went kaput. Then they've started a couple of other enterprises, but are terribly unsuccessful. National Review is basically teetering. It's lost its base of followers. It's no longer part of the conservative conversation. In fact, I don't think it's part of any conversation. And so the only utility, there is a political usefulness of Never Trump, but its usefulness is entirely to the left, to the Democrats. The Democrats see these as the useful idiots of their side. I don't think they're entirely useful idiots, because I think some of them are opportunists and they want to extract money from liberal foundations and liberal billionaires. We'll play the role of the Republicans who bash the MAGA movement. So they are not necessarily dumb in their cooperation with the left. Some of them are very sly and are doing it knowingly.
Imagine the lifelong impact of a journey to the Holy Land. Surrounded by like-minded travelers, picture yourself stepping foot in iconic locations right out of Scripture. Join Dr. Sebastian Gorka and Dinesh D'Souza on this life-enriching Israel tour, November 30th through December 9th, 2022. For more information, call 855-565-5519 or visit standwithisraeltour.com.
After I completed my course, you might say, on the Divine Comedy, I thought to myself, what should I do next? And I toyed around with a bunch of ideas. I was going to pivot into the area of philosophy. Then I was thinking of doing Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. And finally, I decided, look, I'm actually going to go to the very beginning of Western civilization and do a kind of mini course on the two great epics of ancient Greece. These are the foundational epics of Athens. And since Athens and Jerusalem are the twin pillars of the West, these are epics that have had immeasurable influence on Western civilization, on Christianity, and then also on the Renaissance and some of the cultural developments since then. They are built into the fabric of our civilization. I think it's fair to say you can't really be an educated person and know nothing about them. And so we're going to be going through the two great epics. These are the epics of Homer. And they're called the Iliad and the Odyssey. We'll do the Iliad first and then the Odyssey. We're not going to cover them line by line or even book by book. But just as with Dante, I'm going to focus and highlight episodes that connect with each other and help us to unfurl this magnificent narrative that's created by Homer. I'll say a word first about the idea of an epic. An epic is, well, for the ancient Greeks, an epic was nothing more than a story. Epic meant nothing more than a story that is in a certain type of rhyme that was sung, at least in the ancient world, by bards. A bard is a kind of poetic singer. And of course, this goes before the age of writing. These were originally oral epics delivered in song, I think originally at religious festivals. And then, of course, eventually someone wrote them down. Now, because of the huge influence of the Iliad and the Odyssey, epic after that came to mean something different than it did before. It no longer meant any story. It now meant stories that are like the Iliad and the Odyssey. So the Iliad is a story about war and heroism and glory and love and death. It's a story of the interaction between men and the gods. This is an age of polytheism, so there are many gods, and we'll talk more about that. The Odyssey is a story of homecoming, of adventure, of family. And so the Iliad and the Odyssey came to define the two types of epic. You could almost call it the epic of war, the Iliad, and the epic of peace, the Odyssey. And now there's peace in the Iliad and there's war, or at least the after effects of war in the Odyssey. In fact, both epics are connected to each other in that they are about a single momentous event. And that event is the Trojan War. The Trojan War was a war between Greece and Troy. Troy is now in northern, it was north of Greece, and it's now in modern-day Turkey. And this war, generally regarded to be a mythical war, but it's important to know that that is not how the ancient Greeks saw it. So let's throw some dates on here. The Trojan War is dated to around the 13th century BC, so the 1200s BC. The epic, the story of the Trojan War, was composed later, maybe around the 8th or 9th century BC. Our knowledge of those epics dates back really to the 5th century BC, the heyday of ancient Greece. And my point is that the Greeks in the 5th century BC believed that the Trojan War actually happened. They believed that the Trojan War was an actual event, not something mythical or made up, not merely a product of literature, but rather a product of history. Moreover, the ancient Greeks of the 5th century BC believed that the gods were not only real, I mean, it comes as no surprise that we consider this to be Greek mythology. They didn't. For them, it was, in fact, Greek religion. The gods, for them, were not only real, but in their view, the gods lived on planet Earth. In other words, the gods lived on a particular part of Earth that's called Mount Olympus. And they believe that there was a kind of a heroic age, an age before their own time, in which men had interactions with the gods. And they believe that that age had then come to an end. But part of what the Iliad and the Odyssey does, and in fact, so does Greek tragedy, is it memorializes and captures that last time. And think of the analogy here very interestingly with Christianity, because if we go to the very beginnings of Christianity, we find that there was a time, let's call it the Garden of Eden, where God interacted directly with Adam and Eve. And then there was a time even later in the Old Testament where God seems to have communicated pretty directly, even if they didn't see him, with people like Moses and Abraham. God talked to them. They knew exactly what God is saying. And now we live in an age where that doesn't seem to happen, at least not in the same way. So there is a kind of mirroring between the Christian story, in which there was a time, a heroic time, in which human beings interacted with, obviously not the gods, but the one monotheistic God. And on the other hand, the Iliad and the Odyssey, where in the Greek world that we sometimes call pagan, the polytheistic world of the Greeks, you have heroic figures like Agamemnon, the Greek king, and Achilles, and Odysseus. And these are figures that interacted for the last time with the gods, and their stories, in that sense, live on for all time, and highlight in a way that other things can't. The fundamental questions about what distinguishes human life, what makes life worth living, what makes gods different from human beings. These are all the fundamental questions that we will consider in the days and weeks ahead.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.